the covers of other losses. Those of you who may not have time for the book and would like to read more than you hear in this morning's conversation will also find an excerpt from it in this month's Saturday Night magazine. James Bach, hello.
Hello.
John Fraser, the editor of Saturday Night, and you in the preface to the book make it very clear that now that it's published, you're expecting quite a reaction, and a hostile one at that, from people who do not want to believe that the Americans mostly, to some extent the French as well, Canadians come out and the British looking pretty good in this, we'll get to that later, could have been capable of causing the deaths of 1 million people who presumably were under their protection as prisoners of war after the fighting was over.
Yes, that's right. They were supposed to be protected not only by the fundamental decency and the values for which we were fighting and which we thought the Germans had traduced themselves, but also by the legal expression of those in the Geneva Convention, which we always said that we adhered to. When I say we here, I should point out that I'm talking about the Western society as a whole, that is to say France, England, Canada, the United States, Australia, and so on. That does not include Germany or Russia. The subdivision of that, as you've pointed out, is on the one side Canada and Great Britain, and on the other side the United States and France, because it was the Americans and the French who had these disastrous camps and who deliberately disobeyed the Geneva Convention.
If Dwight Eisenhower, who does not look very good in your book, were alive right now and he wanted to defend himself in some sort of court of law, and what we're talking about is very nearly a war crime here, we'll use that phrase a little later, he might argue legalistically that they weren't prisoners of war because he had signed the document that made them something else. And at the moment they became on paper something other than a prisoner of war, all the atrocities you describe in your book became possible.
No legal defense of what they did, in my opinion, has anything to do with the lack of humanity, the indecency, and the corrupting violence that they displayed towards these people, the private vengeance that they wanted to take on them. I think the legal question was simply a sham that covered the viciousness that they were planning.
A lot of questions need to be asked. Some of them are already surfacing in our listeners' minds. I hope I can ask a few of them and give them a chance to raise some of them a little later. But let's now just tell the story. We'll tell your own personal story of how you came upon this in a little while, because that all by itself is fascinating. But let's talk about the days and the months following the end of World War II and the creation throughout Germany for the most part, and in France as well, of a string of some 1,600 camps where the German prisoners of war would be held captive. And that was a colossal number. Was it 6 million, you tell us in the book, had been taken prisoner by the end of the war?
Over 9 million were taken prisoner by the United States, France, Great Britain, and Canada altogether. The Americans themselves took in about 5.9 million in North Africa, Sicily, Italy, and France and Germany and Austria.
And they rounded them up and sent them where?
Well, the first bunch, of course, went to the United States, and they were well treated because this was during wartime when the Nazis could take vengeance upon our own men, of whom there were over 2 million in Germany. So the convention was protected by the system of hostages that exists during the war. After the war, however, it was a different story. The Allied prisoners were released, but the Germans were more numerous than ever. They were up at 5.9 million. And that was when the trouble began.
Now you use this word vengeance. Eisenhower and Stalin, by the way, hated the Germans. This wasn't merely a military man's attitude toward an enemy. Some people honor their enemies and even can respect their enemies. This was absolute hatred. And when General George Patton began releasing in large numbers the German prisoners of war he was responsible for, Eisenhower put an end to it. It was clear that it wasn't merely holding these people that was on his mind, but punishing them.
It's clear to me, yes. I think some people who love Eisenhower might deny this, but he said himself that he hated the Germans. He described them as beasts. He also proposed the elimination of at least 50,000 of them, closer to 100,000, openly and publicly during the war. He proposed that these people be killed after the war. But hatred is one thing, and executing the hatred in this form of the murder of people who had not been convicted individually of any crimes is quite another thing, and it flies in the face of all that we believed in and all that we were fighting for.
And we're not talking, when we talk about a million plus of war criminals, we're talking about common foot soldiers and civilians.
And civilians, yes. Mm. Some of them women and children, and some of them men 50, 60 years old even.
Eyewitnesses describe, and this is, I guess, where it's going to shade into what causes so many people distress, those particularly who are remembering images of the Holocaust and have shared Eisenhower's hatred of the Germans for many years, will not maybe be comfortable with hearing the stories that you retell of boxcars pulling up to these camps where the POWs would be held and dead bodies falling out of the boxcars.
Horrifying images. It's part of European history for the last 70 years, it seems. They just don't know how to live on that crowded little continent. Now they're learning, but then they didn't know how. And this...
But these are now Germans falling out of the boxcars.
Yeah.
Not as the Jews, their victims, and other victims of the Holocaust did. These were Germans being treated the same way by the Allies. As we were reacting to horror of the first photographs of the that came out of Buchenwald and the liberation of the survivors there, other people elsewhere in Germany were describing the prisoner of war camps being run by the Americans as Buchenwalds.
Yes, they compared them. One French army captain, Julien of the 3e Regiment des Tirailleurs Algériens, described the camp that he walked into at Hechtsheim in western Germany as looking like the pictures of Buchenwald or Dachau. And a French army camp in, that was an American army camp that he was describing. Then a French army camp in France itself was known to the villagers as Little Buchenwald. This was at Torre-les-Pins, west of Paris.
Can you describe how these people died? They were not marched into gas chambers. They were starved to death. Some might even say, I won't even say that, it's a pretty horrendous death in either case. But this was long and protracted and took place. It's a question I'm sure a lot of people will raise and I'd like to raise with you right now. Took place when, in fact, there were surplus foodstuffs available. Some might argue the Americans had 1 million defeated German soldiers to fill, and Europe was half-starving in the wake of the war. They had to look after the liberated peoples of Europe first, and if the German soldiers starved, then that was their fault. But in fact, you tell us in the book, there was food everywhere that could have fed these people.
Yes, there was plenty of food. The Red Cross tried to feed German civilians. They sent two trains into Germany from Geneva, where they had over 100,000 tons of relief food. They sent these trains, one to Augsburg and one to Mannheim, where they were, when they arrived, they were sent back by United States Army officers who said, "We don't need this food. It's not required for the Germans. And besides, the warehouses here at the station are already full of food from the Red Cross, which was not distributed."
You uncovered a memo saying that the U.S. Army after the war had so much food in Europe that they were talking about sending it back to the United States.
Yes, that's right. That letter was sent to Eisenhower in October of 1945 by the Quartermaster General of the European Theater of Operations, mm-hmm. General Robert Littlejohn.
Describe for us, and we'll get an eyewitness.
But, just a moment,
excuse me, please.
You were saying sending it back to the United States. The food, in fact, was rounded up in Germany, was seized from Germans, some of it, by the United States Army. This was not food that went from North America to
right.
Germany. It was actually seized from Germans and mm-hmm. put into warehouses. And then he said, "We will send it to the United States, some of it."
There are photographs, although needless to say, the photographs that survive the war and survive what Mr. Bach describes as a 40-year success in covering up this story, show for the most part healthy prisoners. Some of the drawings tell a different story, and an eyewitness to what went on in these camps is waiting on the telephone. He lives in Toronto right now to describe what he saw as the over 1 million who James Bach in his book Other Losses describes having died at the hands of the Americans in these camps lost their lives. We'll be right back to that eyewitness description, to more of Mr. Bach's story, and to some of your reactions to it on CFRB in just a few moments.
This is only a test. In the event of a real commercial, you would hear this.
James Back is with us. He's the author of Other Losses, an investigation into the mass deaths of German prisoners at the hands of the French and Americans. You ought to understand very quickly where the phrase other losses come from, because in those two words were the key that helped you unlock this 40-year conspiracy of silence.
That's right. It comes from, the phrase comes from United States Army reports, which week by week detailed the fate of the prisoners in their hands after the war. And they would begin by saying that the left-hand side of the report would state prisoners on hand beginning of the week, then discharged in the week, transferred, and then other losses.
And the other losses, which I think the first figure you saw was in the thousands and was later projected over the face of Europe and all of these camps, these 1,600 camps, other losses euphemistically referred to the dead.
That's right. It was simply a euphemism for deaths.
Let us talk to one of those prisoners who, at the end of World War II, found himself in the hands of the Allies and saw with his own eyes what James Back has described in this book. Gunter Sagtrop is living in Toronto right now. He's on the telephone with us. Mr. Sagtrop, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
You, I guess, have known all your life about this, but I'm told you were surprised when it finally came to life. Light, excuse
well,
me.
Well, I'm very emotional about that, but God's grindstone grinds very slowly.
We did a program...
We should never forget...
Yes.
...that the Russian prisoners and the Jews, which whom I have a lot in common, had similar experiences.
This is, I guess, what's going to be so difficult for people to understand, is how much you have in common with those who were victims of the German concentration camps.
Yes.
And this was a concentration camp where you found yourself. Just tell us your story, could you?
Well, I was taken prisoner by the Americans in the center of Germany, near the Harz Mountains, where the Germans produced those rockets. And while we were put on the truck, we had little baggage, and was ripped away from us to get as many people as possible on the truck, driven to the train, and on the way west. Now, sometimes the train had difficulty to continue, and it had to stop, and the Americans went to a farmer who was plowing, and just ordered him, at gunpoint, to join us. Left the horses standing there. Mm. And this man, by the way, died later on. When we came to Rheinberg, the camp was near a railroad track, and we were ordered to leave at gunpoint, and there was a, what you call it, lines of Americans and Poles with whips and sticks and rifle butts, and we were hurried on while we each got a little squirt from a DDT powder.
Mm-hmm.
And driven to the camp, no registration or nothing for days, no food, no water, rain and snow. So we had no tools. We used our hands to dig holes. Sometimes a sharp sharp stone of some kind. But it rained in snow, and that's the way it began. And by the way, we had people from Nazi concentration camps. Now, you believe that or not? They were on the way home from Dachau, I believe. A bunch of German communists who spent 10 years in a concentration camp. And they were picked up by the Americans as suspects of werewolves. And they tried to argue the point, and they were dropped among us. And some of them didn't make it. And they went to the Americans and complained they wanted to go back to a camp. They had a roof over their head and water, soup, and so forth and so forth, and just laughed. And they thought they were lying.
They preferred the German prison camps to the American POW.
Well, they want to go back to the Nazi concentration
camp. Right, concentration camp.
Yeah. They had a round cap on, still their concentration camp uniform, when they were on the way home, but they didn't have the documents and to prove they didn't speak English. But the Americans were all gung-ho, you see.
Did you see, in his book, Mr. Back tells us that even when he began hearing these stories, he imagined sort of American versions of Stalag 17, long, low buildings in which the German prisoners of war would be kept. Nothing prepared him to find the men that were lying in the holes dug in the earth that was their only home. What were the circumstances in which you survived this camp?
The British saved me. The British, sir. And God bless them.
Mm.
We were enemies, but somehow, when the war was over, they saw not the system in us, but just people that were pushed along by history.
Mm.
But when a British officer came, two soldiers brought in a huge wooden box. He stepped on it. He had a red plume on his beret. And he said in broken German, "We know what happened here, but remember, this is the British Army. From now on, we will get half the ration. You don't need no smoke. It's no good for you. We like it ourselves. We don't have much, but we will get you home again."
And you saw men, by the way, die in the course of the...
Hundreds of them. Some even went theatrical and prayed before and called on their wives and children who had gone before them in the bombs. And next morning they were dead. Or when the rain came, they had it undermined too far, and it collapsed and buried them.
Mr. Sagtrap, a quick question. Could I ask you, please? Over the years living in Canada, knowing how much bitterness exists in this country, not only among British who might have been victims of the bombs that were being built nearby in Peenemunde, where you were stationed, but the Canadian forces who were being held prisoner under terrible conditions by the Japanese. Have you ever felt that you could tell this story and expect any sympathy whatsoever? Have you ever tried to tell Canadians that you, too, after the war was over, were a victim? Do you think they would want to hear that story?
I would have been called a Nazi, sir, and I was not a Nazi. I was 18 years old. I was 6 when the Nazis came to power. I was 12 when the war began, and I was shot through the abdomen. Don't forget, I had a corset to keep my intestines in. I was in Normandy. I just got out of that falaise encirclement there.
Yeah.
And once before I came from a German military hospital, I could barely walk. And in this condition, I came to that camp. And I had with me people, they lost a leg and arm, and they died from open wounds. And no registration, no... And as soon as the British came, German doctors were called from the German prisoners. Priests held mass, and there was hope. And they say one British soldier, supposed to have saved me, I don't know, I was unconscious, I was 90 pounds. When I came, I remember I woke up under Tapolium, because there was no tents, no nothing, and somebody tried to feed me powdered milk with raisins, and he cursed me because I did not respond to his feeding me. And I thought later on he left me after sleep. The surroundings were strange, so I went back to my hole. He said, "Where were you? A Tommy dragged you away."
Thank you for talking to us. We're going to be hearing from other people, but I'm glad we spoke with you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Gunter Sagtrap here in Toronto. We're going to take a break and take some calls in just a moment, Mr. Bach. Is it necessary for people to feel sympathy for men like Gunter Sagtrap in order to believe you? I get that sense that there's going to be real resistance to seeing the Germans, any of them, even as he said, an 18-year-old, as victims, when we have spent 40 years thinking of ourselves as victims of their atrocities.
That was the hardest thing of all for me to get over as I did this book, to realize with, it took me years and years to realize why I didn't want to feel sorry for the Germans, even while I was working on this book. And I finally realized that I was hiding it from myself, just the way we've hidden this story from ourselves. I was hiding from myself the knowledge that the Germans were victims. It's very hard to admit that to yourself. I still haven't fully done it. I still feel anger and resentment against them. But
the British, of course, emerge from your book in a very heroic way. The Canadians, in the person of Mackenzie King, although not everything he did during the World War was commendable. Irving Abella's None Is Too Many, I guess, could be referred to there. But he did try to make a move to protect these people, to see to it that the Swiss, for instance, maintained control over these prisoner of war camps, and was silenced, you tell us, by the Americans, by the British as well, this colonial trying to speak up on behalf of more humane treatment of prisoners of war. The Americans are the ones who are going to react most angrily, I guess, if they react at all. Have they heard about this story yet? Have you gotten any reaction from the states? Any angry denunciations of you for telling this story?
Yes, it's begun already. The one radio interview was broadcast in New York City, and people didn't like what they were hearing, and we're starting to get some angry reaction from the Americans now. But I have great faith in the Americans. I think that they're full of just and decent people, and they will make a difference.
I'd like to hear the reaction here in Toronto, if we could. We're going to take a break, give you our telephone number. Some of you who lived through this period might have been in the forces as well in Europe, might have something to contribute. Others of you who have absorbed the history that's been written, always, of course, by the victor. Histories of war are always written by the victor. Even some of the German histories that James Bach uncovered, in fact, had gotten their information from the Allied figures that were provided to the historians in Germany. We would like to find out, given what you know of World War II, how you sort of integrate what you've heard in the last half hour with your sense of good and evil in the Second World War. 872-1010 is our telephone number. We'll be back to your reactions in just a few moments.
Tomorrow's Wednesday.
James Bach is with me. He will be very eager to hear your reaction to the story he's told thus far, which appears again in his book, Other Losses, and in the current issue of Saturday Night Magazine, which I recommend to you. Not only does it have an excerpt from the book, but a very, very interesting story of how this story came to be told, which I ought to let James Bach describe to us in a little while. Can we take some calls now? And you respond to them. I'm anxious to hear what kind of reactions we get. Good morning, CFRB. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Right after the war, we were drafted or hired by the Americans to take their duties when they were going home. And among the other things, we used to guard the German prisoners of war.
You were a what now? You were a Pole?
I was in American forces. And we were the guards that were guarding the German prisoners of war in their own camps.
Where specifically, can I ask you?
Near Mannheim or near Kassel.
And what did you see?
What did I see? Well, I don't think, as far as I know, they were mistreated and they starved to death because they had better in the camps than we had. And at one time, when we took some prisoners to cut the wood for firewood for their own camps to keep them warm, five of them escaped. And on my way back, I reported to my commanding officer that five Germans escaped from my guard, my duties. And the American officer, commanding officer, said, "Don't worry, they'll come back." It was so good in the camps there that they, after a while, they came back.
All right.
After about a week, they came back.
I'll ask Mr. Bach to respond to his claim that the camp he saw, and you were near Mannheim, you say? You were near Mannheim?
Kassel. Yeah, Kassel.
All right.
Big.
Mr. Bach?
Good morning. What is your name, please?
Can you tell us your name?
My name?
Yes.
I won't be able to do that.
Okay.
Could you tell us why you won't give us your name?
Why?
Yes.
Oh, why should I?
Well, what was your unit in the Army?
In the American Army?
Yes.
Yeah, it was a unit and a company of, I believe it was 2385 or something like that. And we were stationed in Mannheim, in Galowitz Kaserne. And we were stationed in Kassel, in Junkers formerly known as Junkers.
Okay, you told the producer of the program that you were a Polish national. Is that right?
That's right.
And you were pressed into service. All right. Well, thank you for your call.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
I guess you have to be prepared with some 1,600 camps in this archipelago here to hear from people like him. I have no reason to doubt his claim. I don't think this is another conspiratorial attempt to tell a different story. He may have seen a different thing. Do you know absolutely that in every one of these 1,600 camps, the kind of widespread death was taking place, which amounted to the million lives you chronicle in your book?
Actually, Dave, the 1,600 figure is for the French camps. The American camps in Germany numbered 200.
Mm-hmm.
Approximately. They were very big camps. Well, I rather suspect the veracity of this man who doesn't even remember his unit in the American Army.
Mm-hmm.
I find that a little bit difficult to understand. Andy,
yes,
not
sir.
Dave.
Sure.
There were a few American camps, notably at Cherbourg and at Bremen. I'm surprised to hear one at Kassel. Where the Americans were using Germans as labor to unload ships and trains and so forth. Those men, of course, were reasonably well fed. Of the 6 million, approximately 400,000 at any given moment were in these somewhat better camps. But don't forget, these men were slaves. Although they were fed, they were not paid, and they were forced to work. They could do nothing else.
In fact, you owe the existence of your book to one man whose life was saved by a French national who invited to pick and choose from among the German prisoners of war. This was in Rennes, I think. Found one, put him to work, and saved his life. Would have died, this man later believed.
That's right, the Frenchman, La Porterie.
Good morning, this is CFRB. Hello.
Yeah, I was a prisoner of war in one of those American camps right after the war. I was caught on the 7th of May, 1945, at the Elbe River, okay, by the Americans. And I was put in a camp it's in northern Germany. There were about 180,000 people there. I mean, you can understand the logistic to feed and keep 180,000 people in one place. First of all, when we were given about just about one half of the ration of an American soldier, it got down to one tenth. But I don't believe we were treated badly. And
did you have any tents, sir?
What?
Did you have any?
No, the tents we had, our own. You know, every soldier had a part of a tent, right?
Part of a tent.
Four people together, we had a tent. Sure, it wasn't. You know, it was spring. It wasn't bad.
Do you think that being given one-tenth of the ration of the American Army soldier is good enough, considering that they had enough to give you five times as much as that?
I tell you, we didn't have much more before neither.
Sorry?
Okay, we had to fight.
Yes, of course you did.
Okay, so we didn't have much, you know, I mean, nobody had anything. And I'd like to make one comment about the losses. You know, to watch 180,000 people is a big chore. And a lot of people, they just run away. And, you know, the Americans, they didn't care one way or not if we were gone or not. And I come from Czechoslovakia. I'm a Sudeten German, okay? I myself went out a few times, tried to get some food someplace, and I went back again because I had no place else to go. Sure, we didn't gain any weight in the camp. But we weren't, I cannot say we were mistreated, we were never beaten. You know, we never got too much food. But I don't think we were treated, you know, the way you describe it.
All right.
So that is my experience.
Thank you for calling.
Okay. Thank you. The experience of Gunter Sugtrop, who we heard from a few minutes before, is much more common in my experience. I'm glad to hear this man defending what was going on, but he admits himself that he was only getting about 400 calories a day. And I know that the death rate in Remagen from United States Army sources was about 30% per year. This was measured by American Army doctors.
The question's been asked over and over again why the Germans have not in the last 40 years asked what became of all these lives. these unaccounted for souls who, of course, never returned. Some of them would have known, I guess, through friends, through buddies in the Wehrmacht, that they had survived the war.
Well, they did it.
Not to make it back home again.
Yeah, Andy, they did a survey. They discovered 1,700,000 were missing. They asked the Americans and others what had happened to them, and they never got an answer.
Or they were told informally that the Russians took them. They disappeared behind the Iron Curtain.
It became convenient as the Cold War grew worse for the Americans and others to blame the Russians.
This is CFRB. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm afraid I can't feel any sympathy for the German prisoners of war after the end of the war.
Okay, can I ask you a different question? And then I'll let you speak. I'm sorry, I didn't want to interrupt. I understand you don't feel any sympathy for the German prisoners of war. Do you feel, however, any differently about the people militarily who were responsible for them? Forget now about whether you feel sympathy for the soldiers. Do you think, regardless, they should have been better treated by their captors? No.
No. And the reason that I don't is because the Germans started the whole thing. They started the concentration camps. They started the murder of innocent babies by smashing their brains out. And this is not hearsay. They started. I spoke with a German lady who had come here. She was living in Hungary, and then she was transferred to Germany. And she said, the German people continually say they knew nothing about it. They knew nothing about it, which is a bloody lie, because she said that the train tracks went by their farm.
Okay, and I understand that. We've discussed that in other programs, but I guess...
Yet she's a very compassionate person.
Thank you for...
My mother used to say that they knew, they heard the trains rolling by and said the armament, they knew what was happening.
All right,
and
thank
I
you.
Feel it was tit for tat.
Thank you for calling. I think you'll hear that again and again. And you even alluded to it earlier when you said that we didn't expect the Soviets and we didn't expect the Germans to follow the Geneva Accords on war prisoner treatment. But your disappointment with the Americans is that you expected better from them than you did from either the Germans or the Russians.
Well, of course. I expected better from them and from the French. I didn't, as a matter of fact, I expected this so strongly that for a long time at the beginning of the investigation of this, I didn't believe that the Americans had done the things that were turning up. I didn't even set out to investigate the American camps. I set out to investigate the French ones because I was a little perhaps more credulous, and I thought perhaps the French did do these things, and I had strong evidence from a German that they had done these things. And it was only that I was turning up by accident the stuff about the American camps that made me finally believe it.
So when women like that, and her reaction is going to be more common than you might like, present you with the fact of German atrocities and say, all right, the Germans did these horrible things. If they were victims of similar atrocities, it's no less than they deserved. Your argument is they did deserve better because they were receiving what they got at the hands of a nation that considered itself more virtuous than the Germans.
We deserve better.
Yeah. We'll be back in a moment. CFRB, hello?
Yes?
Yes, sir.
Good morning.
Hello.
I was on the other side, that is to say, I was in a concentration camp. I have no sympathy for these, I wouldn't call them gentlemen. If anything, what they're saying is I can hardly believe that it's true. The only thing that I know about the situation is that Eisenhower, having been a German himself or German origin, when he saw what happened in a concentration camp, he completely became a changed person, and that's when he had. I can't say he hated the Germans, but I wouldn't be surprised if he did.
No, excuse me, sir. Before he ever saw the camp at Ohrdruf, which is the first one he saw, he repeatedly told his wife and the British ambassador in Washington that he hated Germans and they wanted to punish them.
Well, I'm glad he did, if that's the case. But I'd rather not talk to you anyways. I could find better people to talk to.
I prefer
to talk to Mr. Barry.
Well, talk to me for just a moment. We're running out of time. Why would you... Mr. Bach is in no way diminishing what the Germans did as either a country or as a government, the crimes for which they've been accused and found guilty in World War II. He's not in any way diminishing what they did. Why should you be angry at him for pointing out that the Americans might have victimized ordinary German foot soldiers like the one we talked to a moment ago who was 18 years old when he was conscripted into the German army? Why should you be angry at Mr. Bach?
Some of them, they were 15 years old, and they were killing Americans.
All right.
And Canadians.
All right. Thank you for calling. I appreciate your call.
Thank you.
The problem with what he's saying is that if we go on hating people for the sins they committed, not only will they hate us for the sins that we commit, but we're going to be taking vengeance on each other, and there'll never be any end to it. That's why the Europeans keep fighting each other. They cannot forgive, and they cannot repair and improve themselves.
But John Fraser, the editor of Saturday Night and Little Essay, introducing your piece this month, points out something, I think, which this touches on, and that is the fear that within Germany there will be those who will use the stories you tell about American atrocities against German prisoners of war as some means of mitigating their guilt for whatever they did. See, some Germans, he says, will say, see, we weren't the only ones capable of shedding blood by the hundreds and hundreds of thousands. We're not as unusually hideously awful as the world and history has made us out to be. And I get the sense that between the lines of men's statements like this one, like the one we just heard from, is that fear that if we accept your story, we're handing permission to the Germans to somehow get into a little bit of moral relativism, that they were not as bad as they've been made out to be. He's insisting they were.
Murder is murder, German is German, American is American, red is red, blue is blue. They do not change each other. This was a crime, that was a crime. There are crimes, and the thing to do is to realize the truth. If you hide the truth, you will live in lies. We don't want to do that.
Are we playing a little loose with the language? Is murder of the active kind in which people were marched by the millions into gas chambers the same kind of murder of the same degree, and that's first as far as I'm concerned, as the sort of manslaughter which it might have been that took place in these camps where people were allowed to starve to death? Is it murder, pure and simple, in both cases, the same word?
The Russians call it murder, what Stalin did to the Ukrainians. Does it change what Hitler did, that the method was different? Their lives were ended against their will prematurely.
This is CFRB. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. I'm only 36 years old, so I was fortunate enough to avoid living through World War II. Unfortunately, my family was not, and I've lost a great deal of my grandparents' family in the war. And whether or not Mr. Bach's stories are true, I think that the only reason that this book will be remotely marketable is because it is so in vogue currently to bash America. And I also think that this kind of garbage is the kind of stuff that the neo-Nazis of today, who continue to say that the Holocaust never happened, they'll just jump at this and use it to as they continue to try and rewrite history. And I think that's all that this book is going to do, is a rewrite of history.
I certainly hope so. It'll add truth to the record.
No, it won't add truth to the record.
Have you read the book?
No, I haven't.
Well, I wonder how you know it's not true, then.
I think what you're saying is you're saying, sir, even if it is true, it will add fuel to the fire. It will provide people with excuses rather than light.
Exactly. It's just going to it's just a continuation of the world to bash America and to destroy a nation which basically saved the world from the Nazis. And, I mean, you put someone in a front for like 2-3 years, yeah, they're going to get a little rangy after a while. They're going to want vengeance. And had I been alive at the time to seek vengeance for my family's death, then you better believe I would have.
As for America bashing, when you come to read the book, I think you will be startled to find that the foreword was written by Colonel Ernest F. Fisher, United States Army retired, who is a lieutenant in one of Eisenhower's divisions, a war hero, and a Ph.D. scholar, and a 30-year veteran of writing history for the United States Army, official history.
Mm-hmm. And was horrified to see what his government and his country was guilty of and feels the world needs to know it. Thank you for calling.
Okay.
Bye. We wanted to complete our program this morning by speaking to one historian here in Canada, one of the many that the Toronto Star called the day that your book was published. None of these historians had seen the book yet. Quite a few of the ones that the Star reached were extremely doubtful that, in fact, the story you told was true. We'd like to speak to one of the people they called on that first day. Gunnar Bonnard has not yet read the book at the University of Guelph, but we're interested nevertheless in his views of what he's heard so far as a historian of the Nazi period in Germany. Professor Bonnard, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking to us.
No problem, Andy.
You've been listening in the last little while to what I suspect will be an all-too-typical reaction on the part of a lot of people who will not read the book, won't even read the excerpt on Saturday night. But their reactions, I hope, will be different than historians. Or will they? Do you think a lot of people, even in your line of work, will resist as angrily as our last caller did Mr. Bach's findings?
Well, I'll tell you. I've only been in for the last 10 minutes, but from what I have heard, a former concentration camp inmate and then your last caller, America bashing, is the truth necessary, etc. I think this is, of course, where many historians like us who are working in the contemporary field do run in danger of being labeled either America bashers or digging up the past that is best forgotten. Now, having said this, I talked with Mr. Bach yesterday afternoon over the telephone, and I told him that I had not read the book. I was contacted by the Star, and that at that time I had expressed my doubts about the whole episode. And the reason for it is that I felt, as I read then in the Star, my other colleagues, both in Germany and in the United States, who have worked in the area for 10, 15 years, and not even had the slightest inkling of anything like this actually occurring, that we, of course, would have doubts about it.
Professor Bonnard, you've seen Marcel Ophüls' film The Sorrow and the Pity,
Exactly. I was almost referring to this.
Because it took the French close to 40 years to acknowledge that not every Frenchman was a resistance fighter, and a lot of them collaborated with the Nazis. I guess we in Canada and the United States are going to have to start facing some hard truth ourselves.
Absolutely. And yes, there is no doubt about it. And that is why I have told Mr. Bach, I said, I am interested in your book, but I would like to see in detail the documentation. And so Mr. Bach listed the documentation centers that where he obtained his documents, and they all sounded a very legitimate documentation centers. We've all used them at one time or another.
Professor Bonnard, I'm afraid we're out of time. I do this? I'd be very curious to speak to you and a few others in a few weeks' time. As I said earlier, we're going to be marking a lot of anniversaries over the next few years.
Absolutely.
And it would be interesting to find out what you and some of your colleagues think once you do have a chance to look at his book. Thanks for talking to us.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And I'll make that same invitation to you, James Bach. I'm as interested in the story you tell as what the reaction will be to it, particularly in the United States when it becomes better known.
Yeah.
We'll talk to you again.
Well, I hope so. Perhaps before September 15th, I'm going to France to work on my next book, which will upset Marcel Ophüls, I think, a little bit.
We'll talk to you again, and those of you who need to know more about this story will find it in Other Losses, published by Stoddart and in this month's Saturday Night magazine.
Thanks.
Justice of the Supreme Court Arthur Burrell v. Penn in 1964, yet a function of free speech under our system of government is to invite dispute. It may indeed best serve its high purpose when it induces a condition of unrest. creates dissatisfaction with conditions as they are, or even stir people to anger. Speech is often provocative and challenging. It may